Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello and thanks for joining us for another episode of Friends with Money, Money Magazine's podcast to help you earn, save and achieve your financial goals. My name is Tom Watson, a senior journalist here at Money Magazine. And as always, it is a pleasure to be with you. Every man and his dog is aware of the immense financial challenge now faced by Australians trying to crack into the property market for the first time. So it's unsurprising that many first-time buyers are now relying on support from their families to get their foot in the door. In fact, a report published by Finder last year noted that almost one in five first home buyers relied on financial help from their parents to save up for a deposit. There are, of course, different forms that support can come in, though, from letting children live at home rent-free while saving up for a deposit to providing a lump sum towards the actual property purchase. And it's the latter from the so-called Bank of Mum and Dad that we're going to be focusing in on today's episode, because believe it or not, family and money can be complicated. Anyway, it's time for me to introduce today's guest. So I'm very pleased to say that we are joined again by William Moore, partner and head of private client advisory at Hall & Wilcox. Will, happy new year, and it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Pleasure to be back on again, Tom, and best of wishes for the new year to you and also to the listeners out there.
Thank you. Hopefully the new year provides me with podcasts that I don't muck up in terms of the intros and stumbling over my words,
Fingers
which
crossed.
Definitely didn't happen on this episode. Not that you'd know, dear listener. Anyway, Will, to start things off with, I'm just curious to get your thoughts, at least anecdotally. Have you seen any uptick in recent years in terms of the number of families seeking advice on how they can, you know, support their children into the property market?
Absolutely. If I think about my career sort of over the last 15, 16 years in this space, there's definitely been a lot more inquiries in the last probably post-COVID in particular, and I would say, you know, almost on a weekly basis, we're getting calls from clients who are looking to help out their children in particular with some financial assistance, usually for property, sometimes for other things such as businesses or other investments, but in the main it is in relation to property prices and helping them out getting their foot in the door.
So broadly speaking then, Will, what kind of options do mums and dads, or I guess grandparents or other family members, if they're particularly generous, have when it comes to, you know, providing financial support to, I assume, usually younger family members who are looking to buy a home?
There's quite a few different options, Tom, and this is where it becomes really important to have the conversation to start off with and actually set out what you want to achieve and what your concerns are and what the things are that you want to protect. And against that, if you put it in the backdrop that when you look at, you know, some recent reports, the median house price in Australia is around about $1.1 million. So it's pretty significant, and getting that foot in the door is quite challenging for people. So often it's mum and dad that come in, and as you say, you know, one in five people are getting that financial assistance. But how is that financial assistance actually provided? Very simply, it can be done through a gift. That's a lump sum of money that's given to someone. We have more and more conversations with clients, though, about doing that better, doing that through a loan agreement. That can be better for many reasons, which we'll go into. The other way that people often can help out is becoming a guarantor. So they're not necessarily providing the finance, but they're backing their children, for example, so that if something goes wrong with the repayment, they're the guarantor. So they're effectively guaranteeing that the loan will be repaid. Now, anyone looking at that guarantee option needs to get legal advice, needs to understand what they're signing up to, because there are, in the worst case scenario, some pretty significant implications that come with being a guarantor.
Well, I can imagine one of those, and I'm a complete novice on this, so please correct me if I'm wrong, Will, but I imagine that, you know, people can potentially lose their homes if things go really wrong. Is that the kind of worst case scenario there?
That's right. And you add on to that the costs that can be associated. So if there is a default, repayments can't be made, the guarantor has their property as security. The bank comes in, they exercise their rights under a mortgage, property gets sold, the bank takes their money back. There's also usually a provision for costs associated with that sale process as well. So it can be quite detrimental in that worst case scenario. I
can imagine, geez, that would be a horrible situation to be in. Well, I want to kind of focus in particularly on gifts and loans and the kind of the key differences between them? Because I think people probably have a basic understanding of what the differences would be, but I think they're really important to drill down into in the event, I guess, in particular, that something goes wrong. So could you maybe, I guess, run us through those differences and if you're able to maybe touch on some examples of instances where you have seen things gone wrong and where people can, I guess, prepare for that?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this comes back to the point of having the discussion before anything's actually agreed to. So the gift concept is a very simple concept. You're basically handing over an amount of money. Once you hand that money over, you no longer have any connection with that money. It's given to the recipient. The recipient's got full control over it. It becomes their asset and they can do whatever they want to with that asset. So it's simple and it's easy. But on the other side of the equation, it's not necessarily the greatest thing if something goes wrong. And when I say something goes wrong, that could be a relationship breakdown. It could be an insolvency event. You know, we're starting to see the insolvencies in Australia increasing with some more difficult economic conditions. There's also other considerations in terms of older Australians, aged care becoming more expensive. There's changes that are afoot with that. And if you've given someone money, you've got no ability to get that money back at the end of the day. So if you're looking to potentially have a bit of financial security yourself, gifting is not necessarily the best way to provide that financial support. If you then shift the focus away from a gift and shift it onto a loan, that's where you can get a lot more protections. So that loan agreement would be entered into by mum and dad and the child, for example, or the child and their partner, depending on how it's structured. And the big significant difference with a loan is that you've got obligations attached to it. So they're basically determined by what's included in the loan. So are there repayments, interest, principal? What's the term of the loan? Is there any security? But ultimately, if something goes wrong, mum and dad as the lenders have got the ability to get that money back. So if there's a family law relationship breakdown, if there's an insolvency event, or if mum and dad just need to get that money back because they need that for their own financial security, you've got a lot more levers that you can exercise under that loan agreement.
And I imagine this has to be a proper loan where repayments are actually being made, where there's an agreed upon rate of interest or something like that, right? It's not just kind of a verbal agreement or a bit of a nudge, wink, wink in terms of the, yeah, this is a loan, but actually you're not going to pay us back. Is that how it needs to be?
That's the central issue, Tom, is that if it's going to be a loan, it needs to be intended to be a loan. Now, what that actually means in terms of what's documented can vary in circumstances. You know, there has been cases, for example, where people have successfully argued in a family court context that even though there isn't a loan agreement, it was always intended to be a loan. So they've successfully argued that even though there hasn't been any loan documents. The problem with that though, Tom, is that by the time you go through the court process, by the time, you know, that's a 12, 18 month process, it's, you know, probably $100,000, $150,000 to go through and the stress and the inconvenience that goes with it. It's a much simpler process if you actually document that loan agreement properly in the first place. And the way that you document it can increase the success of that standing up, especially in a family law context, because that's probably where these get examined more than anywhere else, is if there's a relationship, the relationship breaks down, there'll be an argument about whether that money was gifted or whether that money was loaned. Because if it's gifted, it's part of the matrimonial property pool. If it's loaned, the argument is it shouldn't be included in that matrimonial property pool.
And just to clarify there, Will, in terms of that example, and this is an example that I've come across before, so I just wanted to clarify, we're talking about a situation where parents or other family members have lent their child, or as you said, their child and potentially their spouse or partner money to purchase a home, then that relationship has broken down. And when those assets are being divided or whatever the situation is, the partner of the family member is making a claim on that money or suggesting that it was a gift rather than...
They're saying it was a gift because if they can say it's a gift and they're successful in an argument, it increases the pool of assets that the court can then make orders against.
Makes
and
sense.
That's often the risk because a lot of parents want to help their children out.
Mm.
Often there's a concern about an in-law or a de facto. And the question then becomes, well, we want to help them out, but how can we also protect ourselves and protect our child at the same time? And that's where the loans become really, really important.
So we're kind of drilling down into this, and I appreciate, you know, there's going to be different situations for different families. But if a family, parents, whoever it is, wants to do this kind of properly, in inverted commas, what kind of, I guess, legal or financial structure might they actually want to look at?
If you think of it as a sliding scale in terms of protection, you can start the lease protection, which is similar to that example I gave you where you don't have a loan agreement in place. So you could potentially argue it successfully, but there's a lot of hurdles you've got to get over. To increase that protection, to make it stronger, the closer you get to something that's like a commercial loan agreement with the bank, the better. Now, the reality is that most families who are helping out family members don't want it to be on bank terms, so we often end up somewhere in the middle. So if we start at the least protection, as I say, that's no loan agreement, you improve upon that by having a loan agreement. You improve upon that by having some sort of repayment under the loan agreement, be it interest, be it principal. You improve upon that again by taking security. That could be a caveat over the property, or better still, it could be a mortgage over the property. So mum and dad are effectively the bank in that situation. They are taking a mortgage to secure the loan that they're providing. Improve upon that again by getting an acknowledgement from the spouse, so that in-law, that this money has been lent as opposed to gifted. And that is quite important, because if there's ever an argument in the future after a relationship breaks down, if you have a document that's signed by the in-law that acknowledges that it's been loaned and not gifted, it's very difficult for them to try and make the opposite argument in a court context, because they've effectively got a document that says exactly the opposite there. So the further you move along that scale, the better the protection is. We often find that most people probably end up somewhere in the middle where there's probably a loan agreement. There might be some sort of repayments, could be principal only, for example. And sometimes we'll get that security. We generally try and get that acknowledgement from a spouse, though.
So, well, I guess the question for me then, for people who are interested in, you know, setting up something like a loan agreement, or they want to get advice on the possibility of doing so, who should they go and see? Is this a job for a lawyer, the financial advisor? Who should they seek out?
It's often a combination of both. I mean, ultimately, there is a financial advice aspect that goes into it. So having a good financial planner who understands the considerations is certainly beneficial. But when it comes to documenting the loan itself, that is legal work. It's a legal document and it should be done by a lawyer, and ideally a lawyer who's got expertise in this area, who does it on a regular basis, because they will know the nuances. They will know what we ideally should have in the documents to make them as strong as possible. The other consideration there, Tom, as well, is that if finance is being provided by mum and dad, but finance is also being provided by a third-party bank, for example, that can sometimes throw up some additional complications. So if we're in that scenario, I'll often say to the clients, the first thing you should do is talk to that third-party financier and say, we're borrowing money from you, but we're also borrowing money from mum and dad, and just make sure that outset that that's not going to cause an issue with the third-party financier, because they might take the view, for example, that's going to affect your ability to service the loan, for example, or they might agree to it, but they might not like security being taken over the property, or they might want first-ranking security and then mum and dad a second-ranking security. So there's a number of considerations that go into that as well. But there's no point going through the whole process of putting in place a loan agreement if the third-party financier is going to say, well, we're not going to lend the money in the first place if that's in existence. So that's why I say if there is third-party money coming into it, have the chat with the financier first.
That is an excellent point, one that I wouldn't have considered until it was too late. So I'm glad you brought that up, Will. One kind of final area that I wanted to touch on, and I guess it relates to the podcast episode that we did last year when you gave us such an excellent rundown of estate planning, episode 225, I think it was, for anyone who wants to go back. How do family loan arrangements interact with things like wills and estates and succession planning? And I guess, you know, more relevantly, is it also important to think about all of these things at the same time?
It's one of those trigger points that we talked about in that last podcast, Tom, that when there is a significant circumstance that occurs, it's always good to go back and look at the broader succession plan so that everything works together. We've seen issues come up in the past where mum and dad have given some money to one child but not balanced that out with the other children, which causes inequality. And if the intention is for everyone to benefit equally, that causes a problem in itself. So that's more of a gifting issue than a loan issue. If you then think about it in the context of a loan, though, when you lend someone money and you die, assuming that that loan's not forgiven on death, that will then become an asset of my estate if I've died. So it has to be repaid to my estate. So it's then thinking about, well, how does that impact on the will? Do we look at assigning that loan under the terms of my will to the child who's borrowed that money? And then it gets picked up in their share of the estate so that you don't have that inequality between the beneficiaries, for example. If the loan is forgiven, which is not recommended because it's not ideal from a family law perspective, but if it is forgiven, there should be an adjustment clause that's built into the will. Again, if the intention is to balance things out between all of the children, because you don't want a $1 million loan to Tom that's forgiven on my death, but your two siblings don't get the equivalent benefit, because you can see that's a recipe for disaster. Might be unintended, but that's often what can happen if it's not thought through.
Sounds all right to me, but I can imagine they might be annoyed.
And these are the sorts of things that can sort of lead to one of those estate arguments, estate disputes, lawyers get involved, then we're off to the court, and what was intended to be something that helps out, intent actually becomes something that causes quite a big hindrance to the broader family. So again, sort of going back, looking more broadly at that succession planning, how does it tie in with the wills? How does it tie in with the powers of attorney? And making sure you're still achieving that broader outcome is really important.
As I said at the top of the episode, family and money can get complicated. So I think this has been an excellent rundown of what people can do, or at least what people should think about doing to avoid any unnecessary headaches going forward. Well, as I said, this has been an excellent chat. It's been a pleasure to have you back on the show. So thank you so much for joining us, and I really look forward to having you back on in the future.
Pleasure, Tom. Look forward to it. Take care.
That is it for this episode of the Friends with Money podcast. But don't forget to jump on our website, moneymag.com.au, for your daily dose of financial news, or you can go grab a copy of the latest edition of Money Magazine in all good newsagents. As always, Friends with Money will be right back in your podcast feeds next week. So until then, my name is Tom Watson. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.